From Redeemer Broadcasting, this is Holding All Things Together for this fourth weekend in September. I'm Dan Elmendorf.
And I'm Calvin Carter. On August 8, 2022, the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago in Florida, the home of Donald Trump. The real facts surrounding this raid are hard to wrap your arms around if you limit your research to sources like Wikipedia. Fortunately, there are other more honest sources available. Today we talk with an individual who was there on the ground, is highly trained in the law, holds a JD, and has in the past served as a JAG officer. She recently wrote a book about the previous administration's overstepping its authority to the point of oppression. The institutions that were supposed to protect us from corruption and persecution had become weaponized against ordinary citizens. Political elitists have used their positions of authority to steal the power that rightfully belongs to the American people. The book's title is Defiant: Inside the Mar-a-Lago Raid and the Left's Ongoing Lawfare. Joining us today is the book's author, Christina Bobb.
I don't know if most people realize, but in order to obtain the search warrant, they had to go to a judge who was conflicted out. Just weeks prior, he had recused himself from the Trump v. Clinton case, saying he was unable to be impartial. And then a few weeks later, he grants the search warrant to raid Mar-a-Lago. And in order to grant the search warrant, the FBI had to give him an untruthful affidavit. You know, they have to swear to what they have for probable cause. And the affidavit was not truthful and failed to disclose the fact that they had already met with President Trump. And he said, sure, I'll show you whatever you want. What would you like to see? You know, what are you interested in? And he had volunteered to help them, and they didn't disclose that.
Also ahead, Pastor Bill Shisko discusses the subject of how the Sabbath is sanctified. Later in the program, writer Jerry Wiss considers some of the detail that marked Esau's life, a life in covenant with God, but not of it. His behaviors and decisions mark a man of impulse who takes his own counsel only, without consulting other, more mature covenant members. Esau is a negative example for God's people to take the opposite path. So much of what we see in society today can be seen as a mirror of the hot-blooded but cold-hearted Esau. Finally, we'll take another look at this week in history. All this just ahead on Holding All Things Together.
We're dealing with the fourth commandment, which is described in Westminster Shorter Catechism, questions and answers 57 to 62. And in 1661, how is the Sabbath to be sanctified or set apart as holy? The Sabbath is to be sanctified by a holy resting all that day, even from such worldly employments and recreations as are lawful on other days, and spending the whole time in the public and private exercises of God's worship, except so much as is to be taken up in the works of necessity and mercy. And remember that rest is included in this. Sabbath means rest. And what is forbidden in the fourth commandment? It forbids the omission or careless performance of the duties required, and the profaning the day by idleness, or doing that which is in itself sinful, which we shouldn't do on any day, or by unnecessary thoughts, words, or works about our worldly employments or recreations. Now, people will say, wow, I can never keep that ideal. Brothers and sisters and friends, we never keep the ideal of the moral law of God. We always break it in thought, word, and deed, because the perfection of that will only be in glory. But this is the standard to which we look. Now, I strongly suggest that probably the best work on the Lord's Day is the book by Dr. Joseph Piper called, appropriately, The Lord's Day, in which he likens the Sabbath to a park. And what do you do in a park? You rest. You enjoy God and his created work. Hopefully, if you bring some food, you can share it with somebody else with you. But that's what the Lord's Day is. It's a park in our week that gives us a break. And then number 62 in the Catechism speaks about remembering the Sabbath day. What does that mean? Well, prepare for it. Saturday night and Sunday night might be a good pattern for all of us, as it was in the scriptures. That's what many people do. On a Saturday night, get your food and your clothing ready for the next day. Crockpots are great for this. Please get enough sleep so that you can worship without falling asleep. Be on time for worship. Remember that element of the Lord's Day and enjoy the means of grace, preaching and prayer and the fellowship and the sacraments of baptism and the Lord's Supper. And revel in what? In the Lord's Day Sabbath as a foretaste of the everlasting Sabbath that remains for all of the people of God.
On the Zoom line with us today is Christina Bob. And Christina, there's so many things about you, I don't even know where to begin, but I have seen you on TV. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm currently an attorney at Judicial Watch here in Washington, D.C., but I'm probably most known for being an attorney for President Trump between his two terms. I was the attorney on site for the raid at Mar-a-Lago. Yeah. I was the custodian of records for Mar-a-Lago. I was part of both Jack Smith investigations. I worked for Rudy Giuliani post-2020.
Oh, I love that guy, too.
Oh, he's wonderful, isn't he?
Oh, yes.
So I was kind of in the mix of all of the turmoil post-2020, 2020 and post-2020. So... now I'm at Judicial Watch, and I've got a new book out.
That's good. And, oh, I'm also a fan of Judicial Watch. Wow. Yeah. What was it like, the raid on Mar-a-Lago? That really, I'll be honest, it angered me. I felt it was way out of line. Can you tell us a little bit of what you went through?
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right for being angry about it. It never should have happened. They did not have probable cause to execute a search warrant, to obtain a search warrant. I don't know if most people realize, but in order to obtain the search warrant, they had to go to a judge who was conflicted out. Just weeks prior, he had recused himself from the Trump v. Clinton case, saying he was unable to be impartial. And then a few weeks later, he grants the search warrant to raid Mar-a-Lago.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Okay. And in order to grant the search warrant, the FBI had to give him an untruthful affidavit. You know, they have to swear to what they have for probable cause. And the affidavit was not truthful. And
wow.
It failed to disclose the fact that they had already met with President Trump. And he said, sure, I'll show you whatever you want. What would you like to
see?
You know, what are you interested in? And he had volunteered to help them. And they didn't disclose that. And President Trump was in lawful possession of everything that he had. He was always allowed to keep the documents, whether they were classified or not, did not matter. They were his documents. The Presidential Records Act is clear. It's the president and only the president. That's been interpreted by a judge already, so clearly established law. So there was not even an inkling of a crime. And it appeared to me that they believed if they could just get into Mar-a-Lago, you know, if we could just raid Mar-a-Lago, we'll find something that we can use to frame him. And they didn't. And that's what I don't think was covered well at the time, was they were trying to bring the case, the classified documents case, they were trying to bring that case against Donald Trump in Washington, D.C. The grand jury was in D.C. The original subpoena came out of D.C. despite the fact that I lived in Florida, worked in Florida, all of my involvement was in Florida, all of that, I still got subpoenaed to come to D.C. to respond to the grand jury subpoena. So the original grand jury was here in D.C., and they did not have enough probable cause to get an indictment from the grand jury in D.C. I mean, think about how wild that is.
D.C. is horribly liberal.
It's horribly liberal. And you know, the whole saying is you can indict a ham sandwich, and they could not indict Donald Trump in Washington, D.C., so they had to move it to Florida. And they had to bring a stupid obstruction of justice case in Florida that everybody knew was bogus. They were never going to be able to prove it. It was always going to be thrown out. But they had to bring it because they had already raided Mar-a-Lago at that point. And everybody was looking at them going, you know, what are you doing? Why did you raid Mar-a-Lago?
Now, when they raided Mar-a-Lago, you were there, I guess.
I was, yeah. I was on the ground.
What was it like? What was your emotions? What were you going through?
Oh, I was livid. I was absolutely livid. Because I knew the whole thing was bogus. I knew
That's
it was
right.
fake. I knew they were fishing for a crime. We had been incredibly cooperative. I had met with them 2 months prior to say, you know, what do you need? What is it that you're interested in? We'll just give it to you. Like, you know, what do you think the problem is? And they didn't take us up on our offer. And they went straight to a raid. They wouldn't allow me to observe what they were doing. They were incredibly condescending and rude. The whole thing was just horrific.
Do you think that the FBI has sufficiently changed since that time, or are we to expect more? I know we got a new leader, but suppose, you know, conditions change. Has the FBI been changed sufficiently yet?
We do have new leadership, but that's the question, right?
Now
President Trump wants to prosecute these people, as he should. They are all
absolutely
criminal. They all ruined our political process. But you have an FBI that, you know, the career bureaucrats that are entrenched in the bureau are obstructive. So, you know, I'm not inside. I can't speak for Kash Patel, but I suspect that he probably is getting a lot of pushback, and that's part of his issue. So, so I do think that Kash is on the right track. I think he's trying. Whether he'll be successful or not, you know, remains to be seen. But I do think he has the right intent.
Well, thank you for being there, helping our wonderful president. And I happen to love our president. To me, he's the greatest in my lifetime. And now I've got a pretty old lifetime. tell us a little bit about Judicial Watch and how's that going there?
Yeah, Judicial Watch is fantastic. We are a watchdog organization based in Washington, D.C., but we've got folks in many places across the country. Our mission really is to expose government corruption and show the American people what the government is doing. So we've got several lawsuits right now. I have one. I just received some documents from the government about the Biden administration. Biden's Department of Homeland Security was well aware before the election that China had kind of placed a bet, basically, on Tim Walz. They were hoping that he would win, and they were looking forward to having an ally in the White House. And they didn't disclose that to the American people.
No.
So we just got those documents. You can go to our website, judicialwatch.org, and we've got – you can spend days and days and days looking through the documents that we've been able to uncover. So,
what's the name of the guy that leads it again?
Tom Fitton.
I appreciate him. I've seen him on the air a number of times. And
yep.
He's got his act together. Yeah.
Yep, he really does. He's a fantastic president of our organization, CEO. He's great. I mean, we're really blessed to have really good leadership, so we're able to get some really good things done.
Good. Anything else that needs to be covered? We only got like a minute or so left.
Yeah. No, I just want to let everybody know President Trump did the foreword for Defiant, so you get a note from the president if you pick up the book. It gives you all the dirty details about Mar-a-Lago. It shows the lawfare that I went through as well. In about 3 years, I went through about nine legal matters myself, whether I was sued, subpoenaed, indicted. I'm currently a criminal defendant as we speak. I mean, they came after me with hell's fury.
That's right.
I want the American people to understand what we're really facing. When Donald Trump says they're not after me, they're after you, I'm just in the way.
That's right.
He means.
Now, if this ever happens to one of our listeners where you're trying to fight for right and you get a lawsuit, should they worry themselves sick over it, or should they just take it a step at a time? What do you do?
Well, I would love to say don't worry about it, take a step at a time, because, I mean, ultimately that's what I did, and that's how I've made it through almost everything.
I'm
this close to being through it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's scary. It's very, very scary. So surround yourself with good people. I was really fortunate that I had great people in my corner that were helping me and encouraging me.
Has your Christian faith helped in this work?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, I don't know how I shouldn't have made it through everything I made it through.
That's
but for the grace of God. I mean,
that's right.
It I feel like my life is a miracle. I hope that this is a testimony, you know.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
To see the provision of the Lord.
If somebody wants to get a copy of your book, where do they go and what's the name of it again?
Yes, it's called Defiant, Inside the Mar-a-Lago Raid and the Left's Ongoing Lawfare. It's up on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold.
Very good. How do you find the time for all this?
Yeah, well, the book, it was funny. The book really was, like, originally, I wrote it out as notes to my lawyers because I knew as it was all happening, I knew that I was going to need a lawyer. I knew that all, you know, it was going to get hairy.
Yeah.
And so I took very, very copious notes of everything. And so when I went to put the book together, it was basically all done because I'd already written it out to show my lawyer.
Mm. Well, so, very good. We wish you well. May God bless you and cause you to be successful for His glory. And thanks for joining us, Christina Bob.
Thank you so much.
This week, Jerry Wiss considers some of the detail that marked Esau's life, a life in covenant with God, but not of it. His behaviors and decisions mark a man of impulse who takes his own counsel only, without consulting other, more mature covenant members. He is driven by the natural man and not by the Holy Spirit, and when he realizes his mistakes or sins, tries to compensate, but wrongly. Isaac's anti-covenant proclamation on Esau foretells a hard-scrabble, envy-driven, and by turns subservient and rebellious life. Esau is a negative example for God's people to take the opposite path. So much of what we see in society today can be seen as a mirror of the hot-blooded but cold-hearted Esau. Jerry is a frequent contributor to Holding All Things Together and is a writer for Christian Renewal magazine.
We move forward in Genesis this week, briefly considering Esau, post-covenant blessing, as against the blessing Isaac bestows on Jacob, as well as the patriarch's foretelling of what's in store for Esau. It is a sad and dismal situation Esau finds himself in, and yet it's of his own making, even as it's ordained by the sovereign God. I had mentioned how in Genesis 27, Isaac and Rebekah sent Jacob, now the clearly defined covenant heir, to Padam Aram, where Rebekah's family is. This is where Isaac had found his wife, Rebekah, when Abraham, not wanting Isaac to marry any of the Canaanite women, has sent a servant to fetch her. Jacob is also sent here, ostensibly to escape Esau's wrath at his owning the covenant birthright and receiving Isaac's blessing, but also in the providence of God to join with a God-fearing partner instead of taking a pagan wife. We read earlier in Genesis 26, 34, and 35 that Esau had no such concerns, since he takes two Hittite women as wives. And apparently this is even before Isaac bestowed the covenant blessing. The suggestion is that this is done on impulse, without consultation of the covenant family. In Genesis 26, verse 35, we learn that these Hittite wives of Esau made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. In Genesis 28, verses 6 through 9, we see Esau take another wife, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, who is a son of Abraham, though also of Hagar, the servant girl, and not Sarah. So Ishmael and his house, as has already been explained, is not of the covenant line, even though he is a son of Abraham. The reason Esau takes a daughter of Ishmael as his wife is because Ishmael is a son of Abraham. But Esau doesn't understand that the covenant is not of blood, strictly speaking, but of promise. He cannot understand this because he himself is not in possession of the promise. We see then with Esau the firstborn and yet the one passed over that he is alternately reckless and compensatory. he follows his desires only, without paying any heed to the separateness, another word for holiness, of the covenant. And then seeing the newly named covenant heir Jacob sent to Rebekah's family to find a wife among God-fearers of his own family, he wrongly assumes that it's blood relations alone that qualifies a woman to be his wife. And so he takes to wife the daughter of Ishmael, a blood relative, but a stranger to the covenant of promise. These, I'd suggest, are the consistent actions of someone close to the promise and yet outside it. A person at the very portal of God's kingdom, yet nonetheless someone also who is on the outside looking in. It's a sad and miserable picture of someone so close and yet so far, driven on the one hand by impulse and then trying to compensate for the bad consequences of this by attempting to do the right thing, but getting even that wrong. That's not to say that Christians can't act this way, but it is to say that God's faithful people will not, indeed cannot, consistently live this way. Isaac's anti-covenant pronouncement on Esau, if we can call it that, is telling. In verse 39 and 40 of Genesis 27, the patriarch who that same day expected to bless Esau declares that Esau will live away from the fatness of the earth and the dew of heaven, pointing to a hardscrabble existence. Moreover, we learn he will live by the sword and will serve his younger brother, the covenant heir, Jacob, from under whose authority he will also rebel. If we survey the history of Edom, the nation that arose from Esau in the Bible, we see that this is exactly the case. Edom is often subservient to Israel, but also envious, violent, and rebellious.
Time now for This Week in History. September 21st, 1942. The first flight of the B-29 Superfortress occurs this day in Seattle, Washington. General Hap Arnold, afraid that the German victory in Europe would force the U.S. to fly across the Atlantic to attack, called for a plane that would fly farther, faster, and higher than any previously built. Boeing's four-engine heavy bomber flew between 30 and 40,000 feet and made its first bombing run on Bangkok in 1944. On September 22, 1692, the last eight witches in the Salem witch trials were hanged in Massachusetts. When the dust settled, 13 women and 7 men had been executed. Also, September 22, 1862, following the Union victory at Antietam, President Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation, declaring slaves in the Confederacy to be free. It did not, however, free any slaves in border states still within the Union. Also September 22, 1961, President John F. Kennedy signs legislation establishing the Peace Corps as a permanent government agency. September 23, 1949, President Harry S. Truman informs the public that the Soviets have exploded a nuclear bomb, and the race is on. September 25, 1965, 59-year-old Leroy Satchel Paige, in a game against the Boston Red Sox, gives up only one hit in his three innings of play. September 26, 1971, Baltimore Orioles pitcher Jim Palmer wins his 20th game of the year, becoming the fourth Oriole pitcher to win 20 games in the 1971 season, making the 1971 Orioles pitching staff the first since the 1920 Chicago White Sox to field four 20-game winners. Dave McNally, Mike Cuellar, and Pat Dobson rounded out the quartet. It hasn't been done since. And also September 26, 1990, the Soviet Union ended decades of religious repression with a new declaration forbidding government interference in religious activities, and giving citizens the right to study religion in homes and private schools. That was This Week in History, events as we recorded them, as God ordained them.
That's our program for this week. Thanks for joining us. Holding All Things Together is a production of Redeemer Broadcasting, and the views expressed are those of the participants. If you'd like to help us continue to produce this program and distribute it to others, please consider supporting us. Our mailing address for your tax-deductible gift is Redeemer Broadcasting, P.O. Box 1520, Olive Bridge, New York, 12461. You may also email us at ministry@redeemerbroadcasting.org. For Holding All Things Together, I'm Dan Elmendorf.
And I'm Calvin Carter.
God willing, see you next week.